Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, a podcast about the important things that happen in between the covers of books, to the driest and most deliberate extent possible. My name is Chris Malmberg, and I am joined by my co-hosts Hans Berger and Patrick Barney. Today we're discussing Nabokov's Pale Fire. Pale Fire is a famous example of postmodern literature for the way in which it invites endless critical debate about whether what is depicted in the novel actually takes place as it is described, whether one or both of the narrators we hear from is lying to us, whether there is indeed intended to be a center of the novel at all. The novel opens with a brief foreword from Charles Kinboat, an editor to the poem Pale Fire, for which he is ostensibly preparing us, and for which he promises extensive line-by-line analysis, which we get after the poem. The poem is a 999-line epic in rhyming couplets, broken into four cantos, written by John Shade, who is, according to Kinboat, a close personal friend of his. John Shade's poem is autobiographical, tracing his life from fragments of images from his childhood and coming of age that presage his life to be as a poet, through his daughter's suicide, and into his thoughts on poetry and death. It ends on the first half of an unfinished couplet, which Kinboat argues was to have been completed with a repeat of the poem's first line, had not Shade been shot to death before the poem was completely finished. Kinboat's line-level analysis follows the poem and at first insists on, then hunts for, then despairs for lack of finding, the hidden meanings of Pale Fire, which he believes must be about his native land of Zembla, and the stories he'd been telling Shade about it in the months that the poem was being written before Shade's death. While the poem is the quote-unquote text, Kinboat's analysis takes up probably 90% of Nabokov's book, and it digresses fervently, perhaps pathologically, into Kinboat's own story, which is obsessed with the exiled former king of Zembla. He eventually tells us that it was an assassin sent to kill the king, now in hiding, who killed Shade by accident, because Kinboat is actually the very king he's been telling us about the whole time. It's hinted very strongly that Kinboat is insane, that the man who killed Shade was not an assassin, and so we should discount his interpretation of Shade's poem. However, Kinboat is in possession of the cards on which Shade wrote the poem, and he admits here and there to some doctoring necessary to piece the poem together in order to publish a complete draft after Shade's death. To complicate matters further, it is possible to read Pale Fire and believe Kinboat isn't mad, that he's telling the truth. It's also possible to read Pale Fire as entirely by Shade, who has invented the character of Kinboat as a particularly interesting lens through which to explicate his own epic poem. Pale Fire, in essence, is difficult to pin down, which, I guess, is why we are here. Before I jump into my questions, I wanted to get a general sense from both of y'all how you feel about Pale Fire.
I like it a lot. I mean, I think like a lot of the questions that you gave us ahead of time that I assume we'll be discussing, a lot of those are actually qualitatively evaluating kind of questions, right? Like a lot of the questions are like, is this good or bad? Is this likable or dislikable? But at a baseline, I guess just to lay out my kind of basic relationship to it, I think most of its virtues exist in terms of line-level writing and structural trickery. But I think the line-level writing and structural trickery are so appealingly done that I at least can forgive it for not really having like character development or plot suspense or, you know, themes in the kind of way that one usually thinks of those in fiction.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I thought it was really conceptually pretty fantastic. And like what Han said, structural trickery I found very interesting because, like, as the commentary of Shade's poem progresses, Kinboat reveals more and more about himself. And so, you know, there was one moment where he says that some of Shade's friends or colleagues think that Kinboat is deranged. And so that's like a hint that what we're getting is not necessarily to be taken at face value. Another like little thing, a structural trickery that I really enjoyed was, now I don't know how you guys read it, but I was listening to it while I was walking around delivering the mail. And so it, you know, the audiobooks is structured linearly. So we got the foreword, the poem, his, and then comments to the poem, and then the index. So the last line in the novel I heard was the index entry Zembla, a far and distant land. And that was like the final line of the poem. And I was like, whoa, that's like amazingly tragic. You know, like this whole time I didn't know I was reading a tragedy, but now I know I'm reading a tragedy. So that was kind of my experience. So yeah, I thought it was awesome. The whole time that you're kind of going through the book, you're looking for, at least I felt I was looking for, ways in which I could see through Kinboat, right, as commentator. Like, I'm trying to read between the lines to figure out what's really going on in Shade's life. Like, what is the real level of their friendship? You know, is Shade just, like, kind of, you know, befriending Kinboat for a lark because Kinboat is a deranged lunatic who thinks he's the exiled king of Zembla or whatever. So what is, you know, you're trying to find out what's real and what's not and what is really going on in the background. But that final line hit me, and it's like, man, I really wish Zembla were real. Like, it's a good story. It's a romantic, nostalgic place, or rather the way Kinboat describes it is full of romance and nostalgia, and it's the effect is to make you wish that Zembla really did exist so that Kinboat could be an exiled king from it or what have you. And so that was like, that was the moment where I'm like, oh, so I am reading a tragedy. Either Kinboat is deranged, and that's sad in and of itself that he's kind of created this land, to this distant made up land, to kind of deal with his own personal failings or his own personal things that he wishes had happened in his life. So that's a tragedy. Or he really is from Zembla, in which case it's also a tragedy. And, you know, maybe in postmodern fashion, you're allowed to pick whatever you want. You know, maybe you're allowed to say, well, there's nothing saying in this universe that Zembla isn't real, right? So I guess that's what I meant when I said it's really a tragedy.
Whether or not Zembla literally exists, Kinboat's emotional state of longing for a kind of beautiful world he can never have, that emotional state does exist, and that is dramatically compelling regardless of the literal reality of the place, because it's equally unreachable either way.
As usual, Hans, you say what I mean, only better.
So, the way that you the way that you described the last line and how you could read it two different ways, and how either way is thematically rich,
right?
Made me think of, you know, the crying of Lot 49, and how that novel stops on the precipice of a revelation that would, you know, like sort of clarify a lot that has led up to that point. And I think that that book invites us to do that. It feels like Pale Fire, at least in sort of like how critics have written about it and thought about it and sort of wrestled with the idea of objective truth. And we're returning to objective truth again. The last episode on Julia, we talked about that a bit. And Pale Fire seems to function a bit like a literary singularity when it comes to the problem of objective truth. It seems possible for us to read it kind of as you guys have described it. I'm curious if you guys read it that way. Kimboat is a madman holding John Shade's poetry a hostage after months of stalking the man, and is now using it as a lattice on which to hang his delusions of being exiled king from a made-up land. Others have argued that Kinboat isn't real, that Shade has invented Kinboat as a kind of lens through which the poem can be read. There are people who have written that take. And then, of course, there are those glib assholes who smirkingly remind us that neither Shade nor Kinboat have ever been real, and the conjecture as to what is true in this novel is a waste of time. But it sounds like both of you have read it sort of as it feels like it invites us to read it, and not playing with that too much. Like Kinboat is either a king in exile who is still deeply disturbed, I think, or is disturbed to the extent that he is inventing this. Or deluding himself about who he is and his relationship to John Shade, and a lot of what he reads in the poem that he takes to be about him, but doesn't seem to be.
I'll be honest. I know that this is not a commonly accepted way of reading it, but I probably, just as a matter of personal canon, I enjoy it the most if I actually read it trusting that everything Kinboat says is true. I actually enjoy it the most if I read it as though he were a reliable narrator.
That's interesting. As to why
that is, I mean, I don't really think that Nabokov expects you to do that, and I think it has kind of a naive quality. There's a naive feeling that one has reading it that way, and I certainly don't think it's the commonly accepted way to do it, but well, I don't know. Why is that more gratifying? I think maybe partly because I don't, this is entirely personal, I can't make much of a case for it, but I don't really enjoy, like, the school of literary analysis that involves kind of treating things like puzzles and trying to kind of, like, come up with the hidden message in ways that involve a kind of like arithmetic, you know. I just don't find that interesting personally. I remember when we were all in grad school together, this was on our comps exam list, and I read it then. And there was a book I read, like a commentary book that I read. I tried to find the name of this book or some info about it, but I couldn't, but I swear it exists. There was a book that I read that basically posited the idea that the butterflies, anytime a butterfly occurs in the novel, it is either the ghost of John Shade or John Shade's daughter, right? And that the butterflies are somehow inspiring and blessing these characters from beyond the grave as these spirits, right? Because the poem, of course, does have this kind of theme of the afterlife and the question of the afterlife. And it was interesting because this book of commentary was really quite smug about this butterfly theory, right? Like, it was basically structured as like, okay, you can do a surface reading, you can do a second level reading where you realize that Kinboat is nuts, and then if you really understand the book, then you see what's actually happening and how it's all put together. The butterflies are ghosts. And I just found that dreadfully tedious, you know, and not really even something that, I mean, it does require a certain kind of attention, a certain kind of seeing to do that, you know, but I think that it's just not something that I find that rewarding relative to, you know, thinking about the, like I said at the beginning of the pod, like the line level craft of this and the kind of some of what Patrick picked up on the emotional thrust of it. Those are more rewarding. And those, I think, are, those don't require taking a side in an interpretive stance, right? Between the different possible ways that you could read this. I guess, like, because it is ultimately designed to be indeterminate, I don't find arguing in a kind of quasi-scientific way for theories to be that interesting. And if you discard all that, right, then, you know, the most surface-level reading of it is, well, yeah, it's the exiled king of Zimbla. Okay, cool, you know?
I think that's...
I think that's why...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, the only other thing I was going to say is, like, I remember, I think we were all in the class where we read Living in the Maniototo by Janet Frame, right? Mm-hmm. And I've used that example before because it's a very kind of basic one for how we think about these questions. Not basic to everybody, but kind of a shared frame for how we think about these questions, right? There's like in Living in the Maniototo, there's an extended sequence in which these characters have an experience that turns out to be a fiction created by the protagonist of the novel. And there's a sense of letdown that you have when you realize, oh, this is just like a made-up story, which is silly because it's all a made-up story, right? But having that extra layer of artifice somehow makes it less emotionally relevant. And I don't know, there's something about having the removing as many layers of intra-fictional artifice as possible that just kind of makes it all more emotionally valid to me.
I think that's why my questions sort of gravitate toward whether you like different things or how you like to read it, because I also feel like hunting through the details for what actually is occurring is very hard to substantiate like that. It's kind of like an endless thing. And it's maybe more interesting to me to talk about, like, I don't know, like how you enjoyed the experience of feeling like you were understanding what was going on. So, Patrick, how about you?
I mean, conceptually, I just found it really intriguing and enjoyed it on that level. And, you know, like the idea that I'm receiving a book of a poetry manuscript that has been explicated by, you know, under the editorship of someone who knew the author before he died. I thought that was a very interesting concept. Like, I'm actually kind of in the middle of trying something similar in my own writing. So I definitely thought that was interesting. And as for how I view it, you know, I like either way is fine. Like, either Kinboat really is an exiled king or he's deranged. Either one is fine by me. As I said, either way, it's tragic. So that's my overall response and how I find the novel.
I listened to it as well, but I wanted to have a copy to look at for a couple lines. And I Googled it because I figured there's got to be a free PDF or something online of this book. I don't want to have to buy it again. And are you guys familiar with genius.com? Like the lyrics analysis?
Not me.
Yeah.
Formerly Rap Genius.
Yeah. The poem by John Francis Shade, Pale Fire, is on Genius. I came across that while hunting for a PDF, free PDF copy of the book. I was just clicking through it because I seem to remember Hans. I didn't really read it here, but I kind of clicked through a couple of the annotations, which for, you know, listeners who don't know, the kind of like a marriage of Wikipedia and lyrics analysis for songs primarily. So like users can have conversations in sort of marginalia around the lyrics of a song and post, you know, their thoughts about what certain things mean. And it's primarily for lyrics of songs, but there's a shit ton of freaking butterflies in the Pale Fire poem Marginalia. And I can't find any of them now, but I looked through and there were a few, there were like butterflies. So some thread of interpretation of the meaning of the butterflies in Pale Fire has made it to genius.com. So I thought that was interesting.
Just a last thought about the reliability. And I don't know that this, this isn't really necessary to understand Pale Fire. It's just something I was thinking about in my limited knowledge of Nabokov, right? I think it's interesting to think about this novel in relationship to how the use of an unreliable narrator works in Lolita, right? Because like in Lolita, you have an unreliable narrator and there's this kind of incredible moral imperative to see through the unreliability of the narrator and understand the truth of what's occurring from the perspective of this abused girl, right? And it almost becomes like, in a weird way, it almost feels like an immoral act to read Lolita without very carefully considering the unreliability of the narrator and trying to see through it in a clear-eyed way. And this is kind of like an opposite mirror of that, where you have an unreliable narrator and the unreliable narrator is kind of, presumably unreliable narrator, but one most people would treat as unreliable. But the underlying reality is in fact unknowable, and the unknowability is kind of what makes it amusing. So it's just, it's hard for me to think of two more different ways in which the technique of the unreliable narrator could be used relative to the relationship to objective truth.
Critical interpretations of Pale Fire often seem to reference Nabokov's sense of humor. And so it seems like another common understanding of either or both of the pieces of Pale Fire are as a kind of a joke. Like there's something kind of funny or something that is at least interrogating in a kind of fun way the practice of writing a reader to accompany a work of poetry like the thing that Kimboat is attempting to do with Pale Fire. And some critics appreciate that. And some don't. It feels like at least one person I found, Dan Chiasson of The New Yorker, doesn't like the poem, for instance, and considers the poem a kind of prank and mentions how frustrating Nabokov's genius is that he can make a poem seem like it would be a serious work of poetry when actually it isn't. And it made me think that there's an aspect of enjoying the humor of this novel that is important to enjoying it at all. And it seems like both of you enjoyed it. So did you guys find it funny? Did you feel like it was something that was,
yeah, it was hilarious.
Well, it was hilarious. Yeah. You liked it, Patrick.
Yeah, like, you know, Ken Boat's making all these comments and like he's reading. He wants the poem to be about him and Zembla, and he's disappointed mm-hmm. when it's an autobiographical piece. And so he makes all these ridiculous notes about like where he's mentioned in the poem, either outright or obliquely. And, you know, he'll say something like his annoyance at being, overlooked by shade or that's not an exact quote, but you get what I'm saying. Like there are these funny little witticisms that shouldn't really make it into a truly academic explication of a poem, right? So
yeah, when he chooses to like dive deep into the word often, I think he does. He's like often,
yeah, yeah.
It's like several paragraphs right. about There's, himself. It is pretty funny.
Yeah, it's so yeah. I thought it was an extremely hilarious work, and I definitely like had the question of, you know, is the poem itself a good poem? Like, if we read it yes. outside of the context of this novel, I think I would think it was good. I think I would think that maybe it could, like, scale back the use of couplets. Maybe, like, try not... Like, I think the rhyming is overall pretty good, but there are some times when it gets a little too much. That's probably what I would think. I would think it was a good but not perfect poem.
Is there a relationship to the quality of these pieces together and individually that is sort of allowed or excused by the kind of joke that Nabokov seems to be telling, where it sort of undermines the form a little bit, and then it sort of calls to question about whether exactly that, Patrick, whether we're supposed to read the poem seriously or not, or Kinboat seriously,
right.
or is it all just a joke? And I think that there's a kind of have your cake and eat it too aspect to that kind of playfulness that is maybe annoying to some who would like this to just be something, or just be a great poem, or just be, you know, a very interesting, potentially deranged person attempting to like use the poem. I mean, I guess that is what it is, but it feels like there is an invitation to read these pieces as, you know, potentially not that good. But I think that the fact is that they are like really, really effective. I thought the poem was quite lovely, actually.
Yeah. And in spots, I do think it's pretty fantastic, actually, you know,
the death of the daughter yeah. And funny as shit too. Like, what does he say? His book of essays is like is like an overwhelming bestseller, and it sells 300 copies a year.
Right. Yeah, that was funny.
It's like, yeah, I guess like for me, it is a little bit of the Schrodinger's cat thing too, where like you're kind of invited to laugh at it, but you're also moved by it at the same time. And if you can yeah. feel both of those at the same time, maybe that's something that Nabokov is going for.
Yeah, that's good. Like, what would be wrong with a work that is humorous and serious at the same time? That, like, that only seems cool to me, you know? you know, I think actually Wittgenstein said something about along those lines about philosophy. He thought that a serious and good philosophical work could be written entirely in jokes. And so I don't see there. I mean, there's tension between humor and seriousness, but not in a not like mutually annihilating tension. You know, there's the tension is just good.
If anything, I mean, I think at least relative to this podcast, like most of the books that we have, if you were to make like a hall of fame of things that we three hosts have thought were really good, really effective books, I think most of them have been both in some way very serious and in others very humorous, right? Like the first thing that comes to mind is No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood, right? Like we all loved that book, and that is like both hilarious and deeply profoundly serious in ways that exist in a very effective tension with each other. I think the thing that I find intriguing about the relationship between the two parts, I mean, we've talked a lot about the, you know, the structural cleverness of it. We've talked a lot about the ways that Kinboat kind of parasitizes it, right? I think the interesting thing about the relationship between the two is the true earnestness of the poem and the deranged earnestness of Kinboat. In my head, I always had it as Kinbote, but whatever. The shade, the character of shade as comes through in this autobiographical poem is truly earnest, thoughtful, has a kind of deep, earnest profundity and a simplicity of spirit matched with intelligence. And at least within the evidence of the poem, seems like a very sensitive, thoughtful, likable, if perhaps a bit reclusive and withdrawn person. And Kinboat, as he tries to present himself, is almost kind of like a deranged funhouse mirror version of that, right? Like Shade's philosophical thoughtfulness is kind of presented in Kinboat as the habit he has of saying, you know, the kind of many people think such and such, and then saying some bizarre thing that only he would ever think, right? Or the ways in which he's hung up on the power of poetry, right? And is correspondingly obsessed with poetry as a vessel for his derangement, right? The way that his kind of, I don't know, the two characters as they express themselves exist in a really interesting inversion that is very effective. Yeah, I don't know that I'd call any part of it weak between the two. And I think the idea that I don't think that there's some core upon which a cladding is being added, right? I don't think that the poem is a center. I don't think it's a matter of the poem being a center and Kinboat's commentary being kind of built around it. And I don't think it's a matter of the poem just being a thing that's there so that Kinboat's commentary can tell a story, right? I mean, I think that from a space standpoint, there's a lot more commentary than there is poem, but I think even that is part of the dynamic between the two, right? There's a kind of economy, a poetic economy to how Shade expresses himself and a kind of absurd verbal bloat to how Kinboat expresses himself. And the difference in word count or page number, I think, is not, like, does not correspond to an asymmetry in the power of the voices. So, I don't know, that's kind of a meandering way to say, I think it kind of sits in balance, and the two voices, the two, you know, in some sense halves, even though from a just bulk standpoint they're not halves, the two are, I wouldn't want the one without the other, and I can't really conceive of the work as just the one without the other. And I think that, you know, you mentioned, Chris, that some people have sold, some publishers have sold the poem as a freestanding text, and I don't I don't really like that idea either.
Yeah, I think that that's it's a bit of going back to what I believe we came to this conclusion with The Messenger, and what was the other one by Cormac McCarthy that accompanies it?
The Passenger and
Stella The Passenger, Maris. Not The Messenger. And Ella Maris?
Stella Maris?
Stella Maris, yeah, that's what it was. That they were sold separately but really needed each other.
Right.
And I do kind of feel like even though looks like several publishers, Ginkgo Press most recently, sold John Francis Shade's poem Pale Fire separately. In fact, they released it as a note in the form that Kimboat describes it as, note cards with a specific number of lines per note card and all of that, so that you can buy that and it is a distinct book and package of note cards, as Kimboat describes how he finds Spellfire.
That's
very interesting.
Yes, though, right?
But it definitely costs a lot of money for this particular package of as Han says, a very small part of this larger book.
Yeah, but you're not going to do it if you're not making money.
Yeah, but I guess as cute as that is, I don't really like the poem without Kinboat's commentary. And I don't really like Kinboat's commentary. Well, you really can't do Kinboat's commentary without the poem. And that's probably why that's never released separately, as far as I can tell.
Right. It's utter cynical marketing bullshit. It's one work. And if you release the poem by itself, you're being a cynical, money-grubbing, greedy corporate piece of dog shit. There you go.
I want to talk about Kinboat. Kinboat is not willing to appreciate how much of an outsider he is. Understand how much of an outsider he is in his environment, not willing to really confront that, and seems at least a little bit, even if he is a king, at least a little bit unwilling to really grasp like the nature of his relationship to John Shade while John Shade is alive and how close they are and all of that. And his story is like very hard to believe, but it is moving. Both of you, it seems, came away really feeling for Kinboat, and it seems to me very interesting and compelling that we should sort of like wonder if Kinboat is wonder exactly who it is, who it is who's talking to us, and still feel like we care about him. And I'm trying to get at like exactly what, you know, craft wise, like what is Nabokov doing to give us that angle on Kinboat where we simultaneously doubt him, think of him as a bit of a, you know, maybe a weird loser, as other people might see him, think of him as a narcissistic, a delusional narcissistic, potentially. And also, like, you know, the way that he describes his relationship to John Shade while John Shade's alive is maybe a bit of a stalker and a creep. And yet there's something about him that is like very winsome, it might be the wrong word, but is there something that like is effective about how Kinboat like is drawn as a character, as a narrator, to allow all of that to be?
Well, he's definitely self-obsessed, which is kind of what comes through when we find out that he's disappointed that the poem isn't about Zembla, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we're like, well, of course this poet is gonna write about, you know, he's writing a confessional poem. Like, what? Why would he write about, you know, your stories? Like, he's gonna write about his own stories. Like, if you want a poem to be about Zembla, you should write it. So he's definitely self-obsessed. So that's one way we see his character being drawn, like through revelations like that. Is that kind of what you're asking? Like how he's being.
I guess. Yeah, I guess how, like, and it's maybe too broad of a question. I'm curious how, you know, how, I guess it, like, it is his disappointment. Like, it is kind of his brokenheartedness that, like, Shade should, you know, have, I think, one line, old Zembla.
Yeah. Jinx.
Yeah. And then this guy, whether it is all in his head or whether it's real, feels unseen and uncared for and alone. And like, you know, that no one is going to tell the story of Zembla. And yeah, maybe that's what carries us a little bit in Kinboat's in favoring Kinboat.
That line is interesting too, I suppose, because it, if you take the reading that, at least that Shade thinks that Kinboat is this strange guy who's always muttering about this made-up kingdom, there's actually, you can kind of sense a touch of fondness in putting that line in, right? Like a little nod to my crazy friend, right? Or a little nod to my friend who has these deranged ideas that I do understand are coming from this place of longing and unsettledness, you know, and that whatever it is that touches us in Kinboat, perhaps Shade has been touched by the same recognition. And, right, you know, that if Zembla does not exist, that it's actually kind of like this nice, fond little gesture to kind of put this passing reference to it in the poem. Even if, of course, you know, Kinboat himself is terribly dissatisfied by it. I can't think of too much else. It, in a way, it's kind of an, it's like, it's a deceptively hard book to discuss to the extent that, I mean, I kind of came in the gate like wanting to chuck all the, like, let's, you know, put this clue with this clue and figure out, you know, our idea of the objective reality underpinning this, yeah, right? If you toss that out, it gets rid of a fair amount of room for discussion. And I think, like, most of what I found praiseworthy about it really is just, like, the fineness of the line-level writing, which is fairly difficult to articulate a position on. So it's harder than you might expect. I remember reading this thinking it would be great to discuss in my comps exam, and then in practice not mentioning it at all, because it's so much of the aesthetic effect is just kind of this quality of, once you get over the kind of, you know, being tickled by the device of it, so much of the aesthetic effect really just kind of comes from good writing, which is a slippery thing to define and an easy thing to recognize. And, you know, for many people, I think us included, maybe a slippery thing to pin down and pull apart like a butterfly, you know, at a line level.
Right.
Well, I think, yeah, that's not a bad place to leave it. I think that for me, like, diving into a kind of fixed understanding of what happens, and I think I'm just rephrasing something that you said, Hans, what is actually like happening, or what the true nature of Kinboat or Shade, or like whether the, you know, commentary exists for the poem or poem exists for the commentary, feels like it kills something that's alive and fun about this novel that is really there when you're just reading it. It's just kind of fun. And even though it feels like something that you can really like, you really want to litigate this book or talk about it, explicate it, but it's hard to do that without also killing it in that way and trying to come to a fixed understanding of what's going on. So, yeah, I love this book. I really, really enjoy it. I don't know how to talk about it, though.
Well, the butterflies are ghosts. That unlocks everything.
The butterflies are ghosts. And
Old Zembla would make a great name for, like, a death metal band.
That would be such a deep cut, too.
It would be.
Like,
it would be awesome.
I'm surprised. It feels like it would... It's such a good idea that it feels like it has to have been done.
Maybe.
All right. That is it for Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov. Who is choosing next?
I believe it's my turn.
What are we reading, Hans?
We are reading Intimacies by Katie Kitamura.
Awesome. Sounds boring. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Yeah, it sounds really boring, Hans, but...
I haven't read it, actually, so I don't know.
Sounds like it's about as dumb as Pride and Prejudice or Sense and Sensibility, you know, ultimately.
You take that back. Sense and Sensibility's great.
I'm the biggest fan of Jane Austen here. I'm allowed to be funny.
You're allowed to be funny by, like, how big of... Okay, well, we'll discuss what it means to be a fan later, but join us next episode for Intimacies by who, Hans?
Katie Kitamura.
Katie Kitamura. And thank you for joining us.